Jeff, let's talk for a moment. There was an interesting article over at TechDirt, again by Mike Masnick, about someone who started out as a YouTube artist. Her name is Tara Naomi. She's a musician. And she developed an early following on YouTube and was really, her career was really taking off. And she was approached by a record label who sort of offered her a deal she couldn't refuse. And that's what I want to get into with you, Jeff. She signed with the record label and then was just very dissatisfied with the fallout and the fact she sort of felt like she was used up and thrown away and not delivered what she anticipated she might get out of that deal. The message that Mike Masnick seems to be conveying here is, hey, if you're making it on your own as an indie, you got to stick with it because nobody's got your best interest at heart if you're signing with a major label. Do you think, first of all, let's play a little bit of her work so we can see who we're talking about here and what she was doing. Wow, she's really good. I like it. I would buy her albums, but maybe I wouldn't buy her major label album, which she complained about was, you know, not true to her style, was much more production, designed for radio play, etc. And so she just felt messed around here by her record label deal. Did she just need a better lawyer, Jeff?
Yes. Well, it's very interesting. I think kind of in the age of social media, celebrities have a very different relationship with their fan base, and it's very direct. You know, in the old days, celebrities were, you know, were icons. They were untouchable. They were Cary Grant. They were Humphrey Bogart. They were, you know, Lauren Bacall. Now a celebrity is someone that you're interacting with all day. You know, via Twitter, via, you know, Facebook, via Instagram. So, you know, celebrities have a very different relationship and a more direct conversational relationship with their fans. On one hand, and again, I don't know, you know, I can't really speak to the, you know, specifics of this actual deal, but look, I mean, usually, you know, music deals, you know, label deals are kind of terrible to begin with. Usually, you know, most deals for artists, whether they're, you know, actors or writers or directors, you know, or musicians are terrible to begin with. And, you know, then you breach the contract and renegotiate. And that's kind of the weird pattern in entertainment. You know, that's why you'll have a huge cast renegotiation for Friends or Seinfeld or, you know, a musician breaking their contract with their label and then renegotiating it because, you know, because they're a hit. So on one hand, this is how business works. And, you know, the record company is going to try to do what's best for them and, you know, economically, et cetera. On the other hand, there is a bigger, you know, question, I think, in the music industry generally of what does a label do? You know, in the old days, the label was how you got your music distributed. You know, you needed to actually have a physical unit and it had to be in a store and it had to be played on radio and you needed and only a label could do it. Now, you know, you look at a Justin Bieber. You know, it can just become a YouTube viral sensation and you can distribute directly to the consumer. So I think part of it is just, you know, business as usual. All parties will, you know, act in their perceived best self-interest. And then the other issue is, you know, what does a music label do when everyone can distribute their music worldwide with, you know, with plugging with an internet plug. So that's my kind of macro take.
Right. Sarah, do you feel like independent musicians like Tara was before she signed are kind of in the state of all of us clicking around the web, needing to get things done, clicking, I agree, you kind of have to in order to move forward. Or do you think this is a slightly distinguishable situation?
You mean to terms of use and privacy policy type of thing?
Kind of thing. I mean, when a record label comes to an indie musician like this and puts lots of dollars on the table and says, we're going to take care of you and we're going to make records and it's going to be great, you'll have all this exposure. It's kind of hard to turn down, I guess, is the problem. And maybe they feel like it's the only way forward, but in this case, I don't think it is.
Yeah, maybe I think there's still an element of feeling like signing with a label is like your break. So you can make a good living, I think, on YouTube, but there's still this notion that the really big people, because there still are huge stars out there, like there are mm-hmm. Taylor Swifts of the world. So maybe mm-hmm. everyone still, not everyone, but a lot of people still harbor this hope that maybe they'll be the next Taylor Swift or something. So I'm guessing that's probably what comes into it. I'm curious whether stories like this will really do more to deter independent artists from signing these types of things. Like, will the temptation to sign them continue to go down? Because I think Jeff's right that it's less and less obvious what service the label really provides in this day and age. So they're going to have some sort of sales pitch. And I'm not sure what that is.
Jeff, what's your take on, it used to be sort of our way or the highway. If you were talent in Hollywood signing with a record label or a studio, is it that way still? Is there wiggle room and can savvy artists negotiate things that make better sense for them?
Well, it was interesting. A couple things. I actually, prior to starting my firm, I worked at Universal Studios back when I was in law school. And I was there when Universal acquired PolyGram, which was the largest music company on the planet, and they acquired them right before Napster destroyed the music industry as they know it. So I was actually there to kind of see some of that go down and to just watch the value of that intellectual property just drop right after the acquisition. It's interesting. The record industry was very slow to react to how people consumed music in a different way, because it was very profitable. The old model of printing a CD for 30 cents and selling it for $15 worked, and a lot of people got really rich off of that. So they completely resisted kind of the way that people were taking an intellectual property. And it's funny, from a transactional perspective, when the value of the kind of the copyright, owning the copyright to the music, dropped as people consumed music differently, what the record company did, which I felt, or what they would try to do, which I felt in a way was kind of panicking and then compounding the error, is they would try to get artists to sign these what we call 360 deals. So where before the record company, might only participate in, the actual, the copyright of the music and exploiting the music and work in that sense, now they wanted more. So they wanted to have a 360-degree role in the artist's life, meaning they would get, money from their touring, money from their merchandise, if they did any endorsements, across the board, and artists rejected that. Artists were like, well, wait a minute, I have a direct relationship with my fans via, YouTube, via, Spotify, via whatever. And it kind of further disempowered the, it further, that power grab, I think, kind of further disempowered labels generally. So it is a big question. What do they do? What value can they provide? Now, you're right. You'll have a Taylor Swift that actually does need kind of this huge apparatus. But for most artists are not Taylor Swift. Right. So if you're kind of that, mid-level artist and you're making, you're doing okay, you know, does it make more sense to kind of, you know, build your own team and kind of have that control until you do become Taylor Swift and you really do need that large infrastructure?
Have you found, you know, you had your own experiences early on in life, and I'm sure that this was all negotiated or signed or agreed to on your behalf, but a major iconic film and TV appearances, have you found that your experiences dealing, you know, in the aftermath of those contracts, collecting royalties down the road, has that shaded how you approach dealing with your own clients and helping them navigate their own deals?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Because for me, it's not just academic. You know, for having a little bit of experience kind of as a performer on the other side of it, you realize how challenging it is for your clients. I mean, you have to be so vulnerable. You know, you have to put so much of yourself out there. Lenny Kravitz was probably a good example, you know. You know, you have to be so exposed, you're so vulnerable that, you know, it's really challenging. And, you know, it's funny, there's that famous example of, I'm sure you guys have heard, you know, they talk about an artist will have a list of, you know, items that they need in their dressing room. And it's like, oh, they need, you know, this type of water and this type of cracker and this type of X, Y, and Z. And they always make fun of artists for, you know, these extravagant asks. I view it a very different way. I think that, you know, when an artist goes on stage, when an artist goes in front of a camera, they're so vulnerable. It's such a, you know, kind of, you know, scary endeavor that they need that consistency. They need to know, okay, in my dressing room, I'm going to have this and this and this. And it's funny, actually. Have you guys ever heard that example? You may have heard this. They always joke like, oh, kind of the most ridiculous ask for an artist is I want a bowl of like all, you know, red M&Ms in my I want a bowl of all, you know, pick out all the other M&Ms. I want all green M&Ms, a bowl. That actually comes from, and I think I want to say it's Van Halen. I think it's Van Halen. They, you know, they would go to a concert and they would, you know, basically put on a show and they would have their rider of all the things that they wanted. And at the very end of their rider, it was, you know, we need, you know, this kind of alcohol and this kind of this and this kind of this in the dressing room. And we need a bowl where you pick out all the M&Ms except for the green ones. We want just green M&Ms. And that seems ridiculous, and that's used like as a joke, like, oh, how silly and capricious artists are. But actually, the reason they did that is because they were doing so many shows and there was so much equipment for their, you know, for their musical performances, pyrotechnics and lights and this, that, and the other, that when they showed up to the venue, the first thing they would do is go into the dressing room and see if that bowl of green M&Ms was there. Because if it was, that meant that the roadies, that meant that the venue, you know, have, you know, put all the other elements of the show together properly, and they knew that it was going to be fine. But if they went in the dressing room and that bowl of M&Ms was not there, they would have to start from square one to make sure all the equipment was safe, to make sure all the pyrotechnics were in. So, you know, I give artists a lot of leeway because I think what they do is really challenging.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. I've never heard that take on that requirement before, but I could definitely see how you would want something in there that would just demonstrate to you in a very palpable way that your requests are being honored and the important stuff is being taken care of.